and often under extremely trying circumstances, he was still the Truman of old. Hardworking, cheerful, never short with them, never petty. He seemed to have some kind of added inner balance mechanism that held him steady through nearly anything, enabling him not only to uphold the fearful responsibilities of his office and keep a killing schedule, but to accept with composure the small, silly aggravations that also went with the job. It was a level of equanimity that at times left those around him hugely amused and even more fond of him. At still another banquet at the Statler one evening, the head table waiters managed to confuse the orders they had about a special meal for Joe Short, who had ulcers. It was Truman who was served a bowl of milk toast, which he ate without complaint, thinking that perhaps Dr. Graham had requested it for him. One day on the Williamsburg, Graham sat on the fantail dictating into a recording machine, his lap full of letters, mostly inquiries about the president's health, his weight, diet, manner of exercise. Truman walked over, picked up the letters from Graham's lap, and threw them overboard. "You constantly tell me to relax. Now you relax," Truman said, laughing. His resilient cheerfulness was both a wonder and, to some who worked with him, disconcerting at times. It was almost as though he did not fully understand how serious his troubles were, how truly grim and menacing his horizons appeared, even with the MacArthur crisis out of the way. Only in the eyes, behind the thick glasses, could the fatigue sometimes be seen. Only on rare off moments would he say something to suggest how much else he felt. Once, while paying a visit to the office of the engineer in charge of the White House renovation, General Glenn E. Edgerton, whose desk was in a shack on the South Lawn amid a cluster of temporary buildings put up when the work began, Truman had paused to read a framed verse on the wall. Written for Edgerton by a plumbing contractor named Reuben Anderson, it so appealed to Truman that he read it aloud. "Every man's a would-be sportsman in the dreams of his intent, a potential out-of-doors man when his thoughts are pleasure-bent. But he mostly puts the idea off for the things that must be done, and doesn't get his outing till his outing days are gone. So in hurry, scurry, worry, work, his living days are spent, and he does his final camping in a low green tent." "Hurry, scurry, worry, work," Truman sighed. "That's the way it is." Another day in September, riding in his limousine on the way to make a speech to a gathering of churchmen, he again sighed and said that sometimes he wondered if it was all worth the effort. Though peace talks had begun in Korea at Kaesong on July 8th, the war was grinding on with unabated savagery. Joe McCarthy continued to spew charges of treason and espionage, the worst of his venom aimed now at George Marshall. Congress was stalling on a raise in taxes to pay for the war, threatening to cut foreign aid, and there were new charges of further scandal within the administration. Earlier in the lull after the MacArthur hysteria, Herb Bloch, in a Washington Post cartoon titled "The Tumult and the Shouting Dies, the Captains and the Kings Depart," had shown Truman working alone into the night, his desk piled with reports labeled "Korea," "Europe," "A-bomb," "H-bomb," "Troops," "Planes," "United Nations," "Economic Program," "Peace," and "War." In the time since, his burdens had only increased. By midsummer, American troops had been fighting and dying in Korea for as long nearly as Truman and his generation had fought and died in France in World War I. And the struggle in Korea had become increasingly like World War I. The seesaw swings of fortune, the sweeping end runs and pell-mell retreats and advances were past now. the fighting concentrated near or along the 38th parallel. Some of the bloodiest, most desperate battles of the war were fought for limited topographical features, a numbered hilltop or ridgeline, where often, as in France in 1918, the enemy was heavily dug in, fortified with barbed wire, mines, and elaborately camouflaged tunnels. Newspapers and news broadcasts were filled with accounts of the Battle of Hill 1179, Bloody Ridge, Heartbreak Ridge. American casualties ran sometimes as high as 3,000 a week, never less than 300. By late August, the peace talks had broken down. By summer's end, total American casualties had passed 80,000, with 13,822 dead. Losses among the ROK and other UN forces were greater still. What the costs had been to the enemy in dead and wounded, or to the people of Korea, were as yet undetermined. The war Truman had never wanted or expected, but knew to be of utmost importance to the future of the world, the most important decision of his presidency, he believed, had come to overshadow his whole second term. He knew what the reality was in Korea. "I know what a soldier goes through," he would say with feeling. He knew the anguish of families at home. But when would it end? Who could say? What could he do that he was not already doing? The worries and frustrations were incessant. One August morning at Blair House, he read in the papers that the body of an American soldier killed in action, Sergeant John Rice, had been brought home for burial in Sioux City, Iowa. But at the last moment, as the casket was to be lowered into the grave, officials of the Sioux City Memorial Park had stopped the ceremony because Sergeant Rice, a Winnebago Indian, was not a member of the Caucasian race, and burial was therefore denied. Outraged, Truman picked up the phone. Within minutes, by telephone and telegram, it was arranged that Sergeant Rice would be buried in Arlington National Cemetery with full military honors, and that an Air Force plane was on the way to bring his widow and three children to Washington. That, as president, was the least he could do. The scourge of Joe McCarthy, that Truman had thought would end soon, was poisoning the entire political atmosphere all the while. McCarthy's attack on Marshall from the floor of the Senate in mid-June was his most vile yet, a wild harangue lasting nearly 3 hours. The mysterious, powerful Marshall and Dean Acheson were part of a communist conspiracy, a conspiracy of infamy so immense, said McCarthy, that it surpassed any such venture in history. It was Marshall who had created the disastrous China policy. Marshall, whose military strategy had made the war in Korea a pointless slaughter. Harry Truman, no longer master of his house, was being guided by a larger conspiracy, the worldwide web of which has been spun in Moscow. In the final hour of the speech, McCarthy was addressing a virtually empty chamber. All but three senators had walked out. The press deplored these senseless and vicious charges, but McCarthy carried on, traveling the country. He still had no evidence. He exposed not a single communist in government. Yet none of that seemed to matter, as he shouted and threatened and waved fistfuls of so-called documentation. One night in the dining room at Blair House, Truman had called a secret meeting attended by Attorney General McGrath, four Democratic senators, Anderson, Monroney, Hennings, and Sparkman, a veteran Kentucky congressman named Brent Spence, Solicitor General Philip B. Perlman, Democratic Party Chairman William Boyle, Clark Clifford, who again sat in, and the author John Hersey as a kind of witness to history. Truman wanted confidential advice. What could be done about McCarthy? As Hersey would recall, Truman gave a pithy and bitter summary of McCarthy's methods. His hectoring and innuendo, his horrors and dirty tricks, his bully's delight in the ruin of innocence. All this was tearing the country apart, Truman said. But what antidote could he as president use against such poison? Senator Clinton Anderson mentioned a devastating dossier that had been assembled on McCarthy, complete with details on his bedmates over the years. Enough to blow Senator McCarthy's whole show sky high. Suggestions were made that the material be leaked to the press. But Truman smacked the table with the flat of his hand, and as Hersey remembered, his third-person self spoke in outrage. The president wanted no more such talk. Three pungent comments of Harry Truman's on the proposal that had just been made have stuck in my mind ever since, Hersey would write. This was their gist. You must not ask the President of the United States to get down in the gutter with a gutter snipe. Nobody, not even the President of the United States, can approach too close to a skunk in skunk territory and expect to get anything out of it except a bad smell. If you think somebody is telling a big lie about you, the only way to answer is with the whole truth. Now, repeatedly at press conferences when asked his views on the senator or the influence of McCarthyism, Truman, though plainly seething, would answer only, "No comment." Marshall, too, refused to respond, saying privately that if at this point in his life he had to explain that he was not a traitor, then it was hardly worth the effort. To what degree the attacks by McCarthy influenced Marshall's decision to retire is not clear. But on September 12th, with great reluctance, Truman announced that the Secretary of Defense was stepping down for the third time. The extraordinary career was over. No man, said Truman, had ever given his country more distinguished and patriotic service. There was a gathering sense of strong central figures leaving the stage. Arthur Vandenberg had died of cancer in the spring. Admiral Forrest Sherman, chief of naval operations, and one of the keenest and best of Truman's military advisors, dropped dead of a heart attack in August. Now Marshall, Truman's strong tower, was departing. Nor were Truman's days in the West Wing quite the same without Charlie Ross. Press Secretary Joe Short was highly professional, but a taut, intense man, very different from the gentle, wise Ross. The only one left on the staff who came close to filling Ross's place in Truman's affections was Bill Hassett, the correspondence secretary, who was of the same generation as Truman, and whose kind-hearted outlook, interest in history, and sense of humor greatly appealed to Truman. Hassett would bring him funny items clipped from magazines, joke with him about the endless obligatory letters that had to be cranked out to every conceivable kind of organization, the absurd proclamations that were called for. And from years of experience as a Vermont newspaperman and working for Roosevelt, Hassett had his own kind of wisdom to contribute. But Hassett was 71 years old and an alcoholic, as Truman knew. With charges of scandal, mounting evidence of favoritism, outright corruption, filling the headlines again, the whole atmosphere in the West Wing grew increasingly strained. Joe Short, Roger Tubby, George Elsie, and Bill Hassett were seething with indignation over the damage done by the chiselers within. They saw the president being used by so-called loyal associates for their own pernicious ends, and his continuing tolerance of them could only mean shame and trouble ahead, not just for Truman, but for the Democratic Party. "My house is always clean," Truman had said at a press conference in March, Somehow, he seemed incapable of imagining any of his people doing anything illegal or dishonorable. The accusations and innuendo coming from the Hill, the reports in the papers were all exaggerated, Truman insisted. He tended to live a day at a time and do the best he could each day as it came along, George Elsie remembered. Maybe it was the farmer in him. You go out and do the day's work. In February 1951, a Senate subcommittee chaired by Arkansas Democrat J. William Fulbright had issued a preliminary report called Study of Reconstruction Finance Corporation, Favoritism and Influence, that implied misconduct in the operations of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, RFC, which dispensed low-interest government loans to business. Among those implicated were Democratic Party Chairman William Boyle, White House aide Donald Dawson, who was Truman's administrative assistant in charge of personnel, and a former RFC examiner and friend of Dawson's named E. Merle Young, whose wife, Loretta, also worked at the White House as an assistant to Rose Conway, Truman's secretary. The implication was of an influence ring, the power of which stemmed directly from the White House itself. Newspaper accounts indicated that Boyle and Dawson both had been unduly active in support of loan applicants. Dawson, reportedly, had exercised considerable influence over certain RFC directors, even tried to dominate the agency. But the one mentioned most frequently and who attracted the most attention was E. Merle Young. Though he was no relation to Truman, Young for years had allowed people to think he was, supposedly through Truman's grandparents, Solomon and Harriet Louisa Young. And the odd part was that Young looked enough like Truman to be taken for his son. As a high-paid, fast-talking Washington expediter, Young traded on his former association with the RFC, his friendship with Dawson. And as now disclosed, he had lately given his wife, the White House stenographer, a $9,540 pastel mink coat paid for by the attorney for a firm that received an RFC loan. Overnight, the mink coat, like Harry Vaughan's deep freezers, became a symbol of corruption in the Truman White House. The fact that Boyle, Dawson, and E. Merle Young were also all from Missouri, like Vaughan, like Wallace Graham, who had had his troubles earlier over speculation on grain futures, served not only to renew old charges of government by crony, but to recall Truman's past connections to the Pendergast machine. After careful study of the peculiar Washington species known as the influence peddlers, wrote Time, the Senate Investigating Committee had discovered some distinctive markings and characteristics. The finest specimens claim Missouri as their habitat, have at least a nodding acquaintance with Harry Truman, a much chummier relationship with his aides and advisers, and can buzz in and out of the White House at will. They also have a great fondness for crisp currency. Truman denounced the report, called it asinine, because while its insinuations were, in effect, serious charges, it also piously stressed that no charges were being made. "Well, now," he told reporters, recalling his own experience as head of a Senate investigating committee, "when I made a report to the Congress, I made specific charges if I thought they were necessary." But like his dismissal of the Hiss case as a red herring, the word asinine struck sparks, infuriating Senator Fulbright, who announced he would begin public hearings. Nor did Truman improve matters by portraying Fulbright as an overeducated SOB. Truman had somebody from the White House staff make a fast check of RFC correspondence and was told, as he had anticipated, that the RFC files contained hundreds of pressure letters from members of Congress, including a number from Fulbright himself and Senator Paul Douglas of Illinois, another Democrat on the investigating committee. Douglas, quickly checking his own files, found three such letters, which he immediately read into the record, conceding that probably he had gone too far. His temper up, Truman put through a call to the Capitol and had Senator Charles Toby of New Hampshire, the leading Republican on the committee, summoned away from an executive session. Toby, a veteran on the Hill, was a man Truman had long liked and admired. But now Truman angrily warned him to watch his step. Paul Douglas would later write that Toby returned from the call looking pale and solemn. Truman had told him the real crooks and influence peddlers were members of the committee, as they might soon find out. But when Democrats Fulbright and Douglas went to the White House to meet with Truman to urge him to clean house and allow Dawson to testify before the committee, they found him disarmingly subdued. "You have been loyal to friends who have not been loyal to you," said Douglas, who would remember the silence that followed as Truman turned in his chair and looked sadly out the window at the slanting rain. "I guess you are right," he said softly. In May, Truman put Stuart Symington in as head of the RFC, and Symington moved expeditiously to straighten things out. There was an increasing sense nationwide that the moral fabric was breaking down all about. For a year now, Democratic Senator Estes Kefauver of Tennessee had been staging televised hearings in one city after another, looking into activities of organized crime. And the testimony of such big-time underworld figures as Joe Adonis and Frank Costello had caused a sensation.
"You bastards! I hope a goddamn atom bomb falls on every goddamn one of you," said the girlfriend of gangster Bugsy Siegel, Virginia Hill Hauser, who wore a $5,000 silver-blue mink stole the day of her appearance before the Kefauver committee. The New York advertising firm of Young and Rubicam took a full page in the newspapers to register concern. With staggering impact, the telecasts of the Kefauver investigation have brought a shocked awakening to millions of Americans. Across their television tubes have paraded the honest and dishonest, the frank and the furtive, the public servant and the public thief. Out of many pictures has come a broader picture of the sordid intermingling of crime and politics, of dishonor in public life. And suddenly millions of Americans are asking, what's happened to our ideals of right and wrong? What's happened to our principles of honesty in government? What's happened to public and private standards of morality? That summer of 1951 came the shocking news that 90 West Point cadets, including a large part of the Army football team, were expelled for cheating on examinations. Truman was sickened by the West Point scandal. It made him feel discouraged, he said, in a way nothing else had in a long time. When other colleges began making offers to the dismissed football players, he felt even worse. As time passed and Dawson, Young, and Boyle testified on the Hill, along with scores of others, it often became difficult to distinguish truth from hearsay, or to tell how much that had gone on was illegal or only an impropriety, or old-fashioned petty political wangling and stock-jobbing. Corporations of questionable stability had been propped up or rescued by multi-million-dollar RFC loans, and too often, it appeared, because of political influence. A director of the RFC named Walter L. Dunham testified that Donald Dawson had told him to clear all top personnel matters of the RFC with the White House, and Dunham's telephone log showed 45 calls from or about Dawson, 151 calls from Bill Boyle or his office, mostly all to urge Dunham to see some very dear friend or other on an RFC matter. Yet Dunham also stressed that Dawson had never tried to influence him on an RFC loan. Dawson, in his turn, insisted he had done no wrong. Acknowledging that he had stayed without charge at a Miami hotel on three different occasions, Dawson said he understood this was a common practice, that even some senators were on the hotel's free list, a point no one on the committee chose to press. A handsome man with a smooth, ingratiating manner, Dawson gave the appearance of someone who definitely knew his way around, yet claimed he never realized that the Miami hotel had a $1.5 million RFC loan. "I did nothing improper, but I would not do it again," said Dawson. In conclusion, Senator Fulbright assured Dawson that the object of the hearings was not to embarrass him. "You were sort of a necessary background," Fulbright said. As Senator Douglas later conceded, Dawson made a good showing. Only minor peccadilloes were proved against him. While the RFC hearings continued, a House committee began investigations of irregularities in the tax administration, looking into charges of bribes, shakedowns, and gross negligence. To his staff, Truman said it was all politics and all aimed at him. He could not see that either Dawson or Boyle had done anything seriously out of line and refused even to reprimand them. He liked people, he told Bill Hassett privately, and was loath ever to think of anyone as evil or unredeemable. "Mr. President," Joe Short warned, "I don't think this business is going to blow over." Meanwhile, Merle Young, who, because of his wife, had a White House pass, would breeze in cheerfully after work to pick her up. Seeing Young one evening, Roger Tubby had a momentary urge to slam into him. He was dressed in flashy sport clothes and talked almost gaily to Officer Ken Burke at the door, Tubby wrote later, still angry. It was the appearance of wrongdoing, the presence of someone like Merle Young at the White House, that Truman seemed unwilling to respond to with appropriate action. And the appearance of wrongdoing, whether representative or not, only grew worse. In July, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch broke a story charging that Bill Boyle had received $8,000 for arranging a $500,000 RFC loan for a St. Louis printing firm, the American Lithofold Corporation, and that part of the fee had been paid after Boyle became chairman of the Democratic Party. "Ah, me," wrote Roger Tubby after returning to the White House from a vacation, "I wonder if this is all as bad as it appears." "Yes." "Then is it as bad or worse than the stuff which goes on in every presidency?" Tubby was 40, a bright, idealistic Yale graduate, and former Vermont newspaper reporter, who had been a press aide at the State Department before coming to the White House, and who, in the time since, had become devoted to Truman. Like his predecessor as Assistant Press Secretary, Eben Ayers, Tubby was keeping a diary. He was also a great worrier, with premonitions of Truman ending up, as some critics were saying, like Warren G. Harding. "Poker, poker! I wonder why he played so much," Tubby had commented on Truman in his diary at Key West in April. "A feeling of vacuum otherwise? No struggle, excitement? Companionship, banter, escape from the pressing problems of state?" Now, Tubby wrote, "Truman has to take strong action to save himself. There are rumors of new exposés in Internal Revenue. Let the White House take the lead in checking and cleaning up instead of appearing to be forced to action as in RFC business. Check, then fire Boyle. Lay about with a good broom." It probably won't be done, probably too late anyhow, to do good politically. Never too late otherwise. In Vermont for 2 weeks. Yes, guess that's right. Truman and Acheson made good decisions. But what about the mink coat? What about that letter to the music critic? So he has an Achilles heel, maybe two of them. But he fights doggedly on for the right things. Why doesn't he make it easier for himself, for all of us, really, in the world? Another day, Tubby would write of the president, "He does not like to dwell upon the weakness and foibles of his party, or even of the GOP. He is a builder, looking far into the future." Once, when he had served as budget director, prior to becoming Secretary of the Army, Frank Pace had asked the president why he continued to tolerate the influence of machine politicians on his administration. And Truman, with a chuckle, had replied, "Frank, you make a splendid director of the budget, but a lousy politician." For Truman, the attack on Boyle was cutting close to the bone. He had known Boyle since Boyle was a child in Kansas City, growing up in a prosperous Irish Catholic family where politics was a life force. Boyle's mother, Clara, had been a Pendergast precinct worker, an energetic, God-fearing woman still honored and respected in Kansas City, and someone Truman greatly admired, calling her one of the best Democrats Missouri ever produced. By age 16, Boyle had organized a Young Democrats Club in the city's affluent Fourth Ward. And until now, he had never been accused of misconduct or dishonesty. Truman liked him. He had put Boyle in one job after another over the years, and from the time Truman first brought him to Washington as an assistant counsel for the Truman Committee, Boyle had remained a staunch, resourceful enthusiast, working hard for the Roosevelt-Truman ticket in 1944, and harder still for the Truman campaign in 1948, while between times prospering as a Washington lawyer. Boyle was commonly credited as one of the masterminds of Truman's upset victory in 1948. Once Truman installed him as chairman of the Democratic National Committee, he became truly, as the papers said, a political powerhouse. No one seeing Bill Boyle in the lobby of the Mayflower or the Statler would have had trouble guessing his occupation. A well-dressed, 6-foot, fleshy, good fellow with a round Irish face, he was the picture of a professional politician. He had a nice way about him, an index card memory for names, and though not known for efficiency or a particularly sharp mind, he knew politics from experience in a way that others, like most of Truman's staff, never would. He talked the language, he had the feel. Boyle's chief trouble was with alcohol, and this had infuriated Truman more than once in times past. On the night of the 1944 presidential election, Boyle had been one of those in the suite at the Muleback who got so drunk that Bess and Margaret left in disgust. "Your views on Mr. Boyle and the other middle-aged soaks are exactly correct," Truman had written to Margaret afterward, apologetically. "I like people who can control their appetites and their mental balance. When that isn't done, I hope you will scratch them off your list. It is a shame about Boyle. I picked him up off the street in Kansas City because I thought he'd been mistreated by the people out there for whom he'd worked. He had the chance of a lifetime to become a real leader in politics and to have made a great name for himself. John Barleycorn got the best of him, and so far as I'm concerned, I can't trust him again." But Truman had not scratched him from his own list. He did trust Boyle again, and remained genuinely fond of him. "Bill's all right. Don't let anybody tell you differently," he had told those gathered for a huge black-tie dinner in Boyle's honor at the Kansas City Municipal Auditorium in September 1949. Truman and Barclay both had flown from Washington for the occasion. "All these are friends to tie to. Truman had continued, sparkling with warmth for Boyle, McGrath, and Bob Hannigan, his three party chairmen since becoming president. They are there when you need them, and that's the kind of friends I like to have around me. It was the old professional creed, politics as a matter of friends, and his Kansas City audience gave a roar of approval. But conspicuously present among the more than 2,000 at the dinner had been several well-known Northside gamblers, including the ruling Kansas City racketeer of the day, Charles Binaggio, who only months later was shot to death in a gangland killing reminiscent of the city in its worst days. The press had taken careful note of such friends present to honor Boyle, just as the press highlighted the fact that Binaggio had been gunned down in a Democratic clubhouse located on Truman Road, and that his bullet-riddled body fell beneath a poster-sized portrait of President Harry S. Truman. To many on the White House staff, Boyle now looked like a very large liability. So Boyle is not only stupid and inefficient, but also, it seems, a crook, wrote Roger Tubby, so angry he could hardly contain himself. He should, of course, resign, or offer his resignation. But these chiselers who use and who do terrible damage to the president don't resign. He should be fired as soon as the president is satisfied there has been wrongdoing. The important thing is that the president be saved from his friends. Bill Hassett urged Truman to rid himself of Boyle without delay. "Your friends will destroy you," Hassett pleaded. "It's all right, Bill," Truman said, as if trying to calm a child. "It's all right." Truman quietly ordered a confidential investigation by Charlie Murphy, his precise, scrupulously honest counselor, whose importance was far greater than generally understood. Murphy's report was ready by midsummer, and at a subsequent press conference, Truman said he would stand by Boyle. No one connected with the Democratic National Committee ought ever to take fees for favors or services, Truman said, and it was his impression that Boyle had not. "I have the utmost confidence in Mr. Boyle, and I believe the statements that he made to me." In his memorandum, Murphy reported that a thorough search of the RFC records had revealed no effort of any kind whatever by Boyle to influence the loan made to the American Lithofold Corporation. Monthly reports filed by the company with the St. Louis office of the RFC during 1949 and 1950, while the loan was outstanding, indicate that the company paid Boyle $1,500 in the spring of 1949. This appears to be entirely consistent with the statement which Boyle has made, that he was retained by the company for general legal services for 2.5 months in the spring of 1948, that he gave up the account voluntarily in April 1949, when he became a full-time salaried employee of the Democratic National Committee. The RFC examiner for the Lithofold loan had never met Boyle, never communicated with him directly or indirectly on that particular subject or any other. Murphy had concluded there was nothing fishy about the RFC loan. "I believe that the facts I have developed substantiate the statement Mr. Boyle himself has already issued concerning this matter, and that they indicate pretty clearly that he had nothing to do with the granting of the loans in question, and that there is no reason why he should be subjected to criticism, express or implied, on that account." Murphy's report could only have pleased Truman greatly, while also reinforcing his own natural inclination to see attacks on any of his people as fundamentally political and directed at him. It might sound egotistical, Truman remarked, but he thought he was as good a judge of people as anyone who had ever sat in his chair. He had made some mistakes, and he had had to fire some people consequently. But, he added, You can't punish a man for not seeming to be right if he isn't wrong. In October, a new revelation relieved considerably the sting of the Boyle accusations. The chairman of the Republican National Committee, Guy George Gabrielson, testified that he had been paid $25,000 for looking after the loans of a Texas corporation, Carthage Hydrocell Incorporated, and had intervened many times with the RFC on behalf of the firm. Gabrielson found it amusing that anyone might think his activities improper. "It is inconceivable to me," he told the committee, "to believe that a chairman of a party that is not in power could have any possible influence." But, as reported, embarrassed Republicans in Congress did not think it would sound so inconceivable to the voters. When, in time, the Senate committee issued its final report, Boyle would be cleared of any wrongdoing. In the oddly inverted wording of the report, he was guilty only of conduct that was not such that it would dispel the appearance of wrongdoing. But by then, for reasons of health, Boyle had also resigned as Democratic National Chairman, and scandals in the Tax Bureau loomed larger than any thus far. For more than a year, Treasury Secretary John Snyder had been trying to get to the bottom of persistent rumors of corruption in various tax collectors' offices around the country. But Snyder had made little progress. Then, in April 1951, the collector in St. Louis, James P. Finnegan, resigned only after being cleared by a grand jury. In July, Truman had to fire two more collectors, Dennis W. Delaney in Boston and James G. Smythe in San Francisco. Eight of Smythe's associates were also suspended, and a few months later, the collector in Brooklyn, Joseph P. Marcel, was fired. All four men, Finnegan, Delaney, Smythe, and Marcel, had been appointed by Bob Hannigan when Hannigan was head of the Bureau of Internal Revenue under Roosevelt, and all had taken their jobs with the understanding that tax collection need only be a part-time responsibility, that they were free to do other things as well. Like Hannigan, all four men were also the products of big-city Democratic machines, and in fact corrupt practices, or at the least flagrant irregularities, had been rampant during their terms of office. Finnegan was indicted for bribe-taking and misconduct, Delaney, the Boston collector, for taking bribes to fix tax delinquencies. In San Francisco, Smythe, too, was indicted for fixing tax fraud claims, and in Brooklyn, Marcel was found to have cheated on his own tax returns and amassed through his law practice nearly $250,000 beyond his $10,750-a-year salary as tax collector. Meantime, the Commissioner of Internal Revenue, George J. Shaneman, had suddenly resigned for reasons of health, and the resignations of the Assistant Commissioner, Daniel A. Bullich, and the Bureau's Chief Counsel, Charles Oliphant, followed almost immediately. In November, Truman had to fire the head of the tax division at the Justice Department, Assistant Attorney General T. Lamar Caudill. A House Investigation Committee would conclude that Caudill, though undoubtedly an honorable man, had been naive in his dealings with tax fixers. By December, George Elsie would report in a White House memorandum that signs of corruption were spreading so fast the staff was unable to document them all. In Truman's defense, it was stressed that the tax collectors under fire were holdovers from the Roosevelt administration. Also, Truman had moved swiftly and forcefully to clean house in the Tax Bureau, a point no one could contest. By December, 113 employees of the Internal Revenue Bureau including 6 regional collectors, had been fired from their jobs. When Boyle was replaced by a new Democratic National Chairman, Frank E. McKinney, Truman also determined that collectors of the Internal Revenue would no longer be patronage jobs, but put under civil service. Nonetheless, corruption in the Tax Bureau was truly appalling, the house cleaning long overdue. And if Bob Hannigan had made his key appointments under Roosevelt, Hannigan had also been known as a thorough Truman man, another Missouri crony. Hannigan had himself been a first-rate head of the Tax Bureau, but Hannigan was no longer available to speak in his own defense. He had died of heart failure in October 1949. And whatever the comparative guilt or stupidity of an unfortunate figure like T. Lamar Caudle, it would be remembered that his wife, too, was the recipient of a mink coat, a Christmas present from an attorney who had dealings with the tax division. Would he be taking drastic action to clean up the government? Truman was asked at a press conference in December. Let's say continue drastic action, he replied. Wrongdoers have no house with me, he said, an expression that left reporters looking puzzled and that Truman later told his staff he had used since boyhood. Time would report that it was a colloquialism as old at least as Romeo and Juliet, where Juliet's father, angry with her for refusing to marry Paris, tells her, "Graze where you will, you shall not house with me." Did he ever feel as though he had been sold down the river by his friends? Well, who wouldn't feel that way? He snapped angrily. But beyond that, he would say no more. "Boss, you're going to have to run in 52, Harry Vaughn told him one day as Truman sat at his desk. "Who else is there?" "We'll get someone," Truman answered, a twinkle in his eye. "You know there isn't anybody else. You'll have to run." "We'll see," said Truman, and Vaughn came out of the office, convinced the president would run again. Vaughn, as he told the others, had no misconceptions about what was ahead for him personally should Truman not run. "Once I'm out of the White House," Vaughn said one noon hour in the staff lunchroom downstairs, "I know perfectly well that these jokers who bow and scrape and call me general would pass me by on the street and if they saw me say, 'Why, there goes that fat goddamn son of a bitch.'" It was one of those moments when several of the staff were reminded why, after all, the president had kept Vaughn around for so long. The only one not pointedly urging Truman to run again was Bill Hassett, who was due to retire soon himself, and who told Truman that for his own sake and the sake of his family, he should do the same. In Korea, though peace talks had resumed, now at Panmunjom, the war went on. The sticking point in the talks was the fate of 132,000 North Korean soldiers held prisoner by the UN command. Originally, it had been agreed that the end of hostilities would bring an immediate exchange of all prisoners. But now, the United States opposed that policy, since nearly half of the North Korean prisoners of war, some 62,000, had no wish to be repatriated. Truman insisted that they be given the choice of whether to go home. At the end of World War II, Stalin had executed, or sent to Siberia, thousands of Soviet soldiers whose only crime was to have been captured by the enemy. "We will not buy an armistice by turning over human beings for slaughter or slavery," Truman declared, and he would not be budged. American casualties in Korea were now far less than in the first year of the war. Still, every week meant more death and suffering. Korea was consuming lives and resources, poisoning American politics, devastating Truman's presidency. No one wanted the war ended more than he. According to the polls, half the American people favored using the atomic bomb to get it over with. And though determined to keep to his policy of restraint, even he had his own fantasies about the ultimatum he might hand the Soviets. In another of his solitary ventings of anger and frustration, a lengthy private soliloquy in longhand, he wrote, "Dealing with communist governments is like an honest man trying to deal with a numbers racket king or the head of a dope ring. It seems to me that the proper approach now would be an ultimatum with a 10-day expiration limit, informing Moscow that we intend to blockade the China coast from the Korean border to Indochina, and that we intend to destroy every military base in Manchuria, including submarine bases, by means now in our control, and if there is further interference, we shall eliminate any ports or cities necessary to accomplish our peaceful purposes. That this situation can be avoided by the withdrawal of all Chinese troops from Korea and the stoppage of all supplies of war and materials by Russia to Communist China. We mean business. We did not start this Korean affair, but we intend to end it for the benefit of the Korean people, the authority of the United Nations, and the peace of the world. We are tired of these phony calls for peace when there is no intention to make an honest approach to peace. Stop supplying war materials to the thugs who are attacking the free world, and settle down to an honorable policy of keeping agreements which have already been made. This means all-out war. It means that Moscow, St. Petersburg, Mukden, Vladivostok, Peking, Shanghai, Port Arthur, Dairen, Odessa, Stalingrad, and every manufacturing plant in China and the Soviet Union will be eliminated. This is the final chance for the Soviet government to decide whether it desires to survive or not." But no one heard him ever say such things. He had no such intentions. The 7 sheets of desk notepaper that he had filled were put away in a drawer, and on he went with the hard work of his responsibilities. "I know of no easy way to be president," he would say. At Washington dinner parties, and increasingly to reporters, prominent Republicans talked almost gleefully of the damnedest campaign ever in 1952 on the issues of communism, corruption, and Korea. Taft was already running. Others, Republicans and Democrats, spoke more and more of Eisenhower as the ideal candidate. By December, Attorney General McGrath was being questioned by the House committee investigating the Internal Revenue scandals, and Truman's standing in the polls had fallen to an all-time low. Only 23% of the country approved of how he was handling his job. But by then, the staff had been told. In mid-November, during a brief vacation at Key West, Truman had gathered them about the poker table on the porch at the little White House to read aloud the statement he had written on April 12, 1950, and that he planned to release in the coming spring, in April 1952, well in advance of the Democratic National Convention. He was not running again. But for the next 5 months, he cautioned them, there must be utmost secrecy. He was only telling them now, he explained, so they could start making their own plans. Once having told them, he seemed greatly relieved. "From that day forward," Roger Tubby was to write several months later, "I have not discerned any difference in any of our feelings for or relations with the President. We are, and I think it proper to generalize for the staff, devoted to him as before." Later still, it would be seen as a measure of that devotion that none of those who knew Truman's plans for 1952 ever said a word. The secret was kept for 5 months, as he had asked. In the first week of the new year, on January 5, 1952, Winston Churchill, who in recent months at 77 had returned to office as Prime Minister, arrived for a brief visit. Churchill had sailed on the Queen Mary. Truman sent the Independence to New York to bring him to Washington, and Truman was there at National Airport to welcome him. Churchill, white-haired, wearing the familiar derby and smoking a long cigar, looked greatly aged, more stooped than ever, his walk slower. But to those watching, as he and Truman greeted one another, he was the old warrior, the old lion still, with an air of dramatic dignity about him. To Truman, Churchill was the greatest public figure of the age, as he often said. To Dean Acheson, this was an understatement. One would have to go back 4 centuries to find his equal, Acheson insisted. What Churchill did was great. How he did it was equally so. Everything felt the touch of his art, his appearance and gestures. That evening, following dinner on board the Williamsburg, the table cleared, Churchill began talking of the state of the world, the menace and paradoxes of the Soviet Empire. He acknowledged the importance of American nuclear power and warmly praised Truman's leadership of the free world, including, as Churchill said, Truman's great decision to commit American forces in Korea. For Acheson, Averell Harriman, and others present, it was an occasion to be long remembered. Looking at Truman, Churchill said slowly, "The last time you and I sat across the conference table was at Potsdam, Mr. President." Truman nodded. "I must confess, sir," Churchill went on, "I held you in very low regard then. I loathed your taking the place of Franklin Roosevelt." He paused. "I misjudged you badly. Since that time, you, more than any other man, have saved Western civilization." In a dark period for Harry Truman, a winter of tawdry scandal, of interminable war in Korea and greatly diminished public confidence in his leadership, the gallant old ally had again, and as only he could, served as a voice of affirmation. Section 2. During his initial years in the White House, Truman had often referred to it derisively as the Great White Jail, the Great White Sepulchre of Ambitions, or the Taxpayer's House. He had found living there difficult, often very lonely. But he was also the president who, with the war over, re-established state dinners and receptions in the grand formal rooms of the mansion, insisting on respect for tradition in most every detail. He and the First Lady had returned pageantry to the White House, as J.B. West said, and plainly this had given him great pleasure. As much, perhaps, as anyone who had ever lived there, Truman felt the aura of the old structure's past, the lingering presence of the strong personalities who had been its occupants down the years, even to the point some nights of hearing their ghosts stalking the center hall upstairs or knocking at his door. As Ethel Noland and others had observed, history for Truman was never just something in a book, but part of life, and of interest primarily because it had to do with people. Often, when he spoke of Andrew Jackson or John Quincy Adams or Abraham Lincoln, it was as if he were talking about someone he knew. One cold Saturday morning near the end of 1950, he had led John Hersey on a tour of the White House renovation, at a time when the inside of the building looked like any big construction project, with steel beams, raw concrete floors, and metal ductwork contained within the shell of the old exterior walls. There were no partitions. Nothing remained of the original interior. It looked, thought Hersey, as if someone had decided to set up a modern office inside a deserted castle. Yet Truman stepped briskly along, describing the historic features of one room after another, as though they were all still there, everything in place. The tour became a kind of fantasy, a game of imagining, as Hersey wrote. Truman pointed out the red room, the blue room, the green room, and then, at the far end, the east room. "You know, the White House was started in 1792," he said, "and the first ones to move in were John Adams and his wife in 1800. And when they moved in, only 6 rooms in the whole building were ready to be lived in. This east room was just a stone shell, so Abigail Adams used to string up her wash to dry in here. Imagine it. Later on, when the room was dolled up, Jackson bought 20 spittoons to go in here. They cost $12.50 apiece." When Hersey asked if the intention was to restore the interior more or less as it had been before the building was dismantled, Truman answered emphatically, "Oh, yes, indeed." History aside, Truman also understood the building's immense power as symbol. Since his first weeks in office, he had made steady use of such lesser symbols as the presidential yacht, the presidential plane, railroad car, and limousines. It was not just that he enjoyed them, but that he knew the degree to which they represented the dignity and importance of the office. Now, in an ironic bit of timing, as his tormentors in the press and opposition party made much over the mess in Washington, by use of such other symbols as deep freezers and mink coats, Truman found some relief from his daily burdens, welcome diversion from war and scandals and politics, in the work of saving and returning to service the ultimate symbol of his high place in American life. The creator of acclaimed Missouri roads and courthouses, and of what had become the nation's best-known balcony, could be a builder again, restorer and guardian of one of democracy's shrines, the oldest building of the federal city. And little else that he was able to accomplish in these last years of his presidency would give him such satisfaction. From its beginning stages, he had cared intensely about the project. "It is the president's desire," the official White House architect Lorenzo Winslow had written in the spring of 1949, "that this restoration be made so thoroughly complete that the structural condition and all principal and fixed architectural finishes will be permanent for many generations to come." The first dismantling had begun December 13, 1949, after 6 months of planning. Truman had hoped to have full responsibility for the project. It was, after all, the president's house, but was turned down by Congress. A congressional commission on the renovation of the executive mansion was established, its 6 members appointed by the president, including 2 from the Senate, 2 from the House, the president of the American Society of Civil Engineers, and the president of the American Institute of Architects. The senior member of the commission, old Kenneth McKellar of Tennessee, the president pro tempore of the Senate, who was by then 80, became chairman, while Glenn E. Edgerton, a retired major general from the office of the Army Chief of Staff, was made executive director of the work. But it was the White House architect, Winslow, who worked most directly with Truman. And it was to be Truman, in the last analysis, who made nearly all the major decisions, and a good many others as well. The last major overhaul of the old mansion had been in Theodore Roosevelt's day, in 1902. Under the direction of Charles McKim, of the renowned New York architectural firm of McKim, Mead, and White, the main floor especially had been transformed from something resembling a dowdy Victorian hotel to a kind of Beaux-Arts elegance, with the added touch of magnificent new electrical light fixtures and chandeliers. But the work was fundamentally cosmetic and accomplished in a huge rush. Structural needs had been bypassed, making the house in all less stable than it had been before. It had been truly a botch job, as Truman said, and a principal cause of the conditions Truman faced 47 years later. Although the exterior sandstone walls, the roof, and a fire-resistant third floor that had been added in the 1920s during the Coolidge era were in stable condition, the rest of the house was on the verge of collapse and a fearful fire hazard. Great loads had been put on the interior bearing walls. Beams had been notched or cut for plumbing or electrical wiring. The entire second floor, most of which had been rebuilt after British soldiers burned the house in 1814, was unsafe. The character and extent of structural weakness were found to be truly appalling, said the Commissioner of Public Buildings in his report. Winslow had claimed he could prove mathematically that it was impossible for the house to remain standing. The plumbing was all largely makeshift and long outdated. The heating system and electrical wiring, all inadequate and obsolete. The main question to be decided in 1949 was whether to remove the existing interior of the house below the third floor, keeping the outside walls, and then rebuild everything within, or to take down the whole building, preserving and numbering the exterior stones in the process so they could be reassembled when the new building went up. In the words of a later report, "The decision between these plans presented a matter of not inconsiderable complexity, especially since there were involved not only the construction factors, but the compelling sentimental aspects of the matter." To have proceeded by dismantling the outside walls would have made the project less difficult and less costly, saving as much as $300,000 or $400,000. But only one member of the commission, Democratic Congressman Lewis C. Rabaut of Michigan, had argued for that approach. To the rest, tearing down the White House was unacceptable. It would have seemed an act of desecration. Truman never considered the idea. Had he and the commission decided otherwise, the walls of the White House would have begun coming down in early 1950, as McCarthy was beginning his assault. The country would have had to have seen the complete demolition of the building down to the ground at about the time the news from Korea had turned so dreadful the following summer, with American troops fighting desperately to hang on at the Pusan perimeter. As it was, the exterior remained intact, while within, everything below the third floor was removed, piece by careful piece to begin with, after which came the full-scale demolition, until the entire inside was hollowed out and the house had become a cavernous, empty shell, the old outside walls held in place by steel framing. Trucks and bulldozers moved in to begin excavation for two entirely new basement levels. It was an extraordinary sight. "They took the insides all out," Truman wrote in his diary. "Dug two basements, put in steel and concrete like you've never seen in the Empire State Building, Pentagon, or anywhere else." He loved making inspection tours, often using the workers' catwalks high above ground. The work was projected to cost $5,412,000 and be completed by December 1951. John McShane Incorporated of Philadelphia was, as low bidder, made general contractor. The firm had built the Pentagon, the Jefferson Memorial, and had a high reputation in Washington. But when Truman, walking over from Blair House one morning, saw a big McShane sign on the north lawn of the White House, he told head usher Howell Krim to have that thing removed at once. The project was far bigger and more complicated than commonly appreciated. Most of Washington and the country never realized all that was involved or the extent to which it would become the house that Harry Truman built. For 149 years, the outside walls of the house had been standing on clay. Now, for proper underpinning, 4-foot-square pits were dug to a depth of about 25 feet down to a firm stratum of gravel, some 126 pits in all. These filled with reinforced concrete, thereby forming the foundation for the structural steel frame of the house that went up within the original walls. The old brick of the interior bearing walls, the backing for the stone, was also found to be too soft and had to be removed, thus for the first time revealing the inside surfaces of the original stones, many of which, to Truman's delight, bore the mark of Masonic symbols. He was also pleased to learn that on the Saturday in October 1792, when the Freemasons of Georgetown had laid the first stone, in the presence of President George Washington and the architect of the house, James Hoban, they had afterward paraded back to Georgetown to Mr. Sutter's Fountain Inn, where toasts were raised to the 15 United States, the President, and Masonic brethren throughout the universe. Original ornamental plaster cornices designed by James Hoban were found in the East Room, hidden behind plaster put on in 1902. A well dug by Thomas Jefferson was discovered beneath the east wall. In his temporary office out on the South Lawn, General Edgerton kept an assortment of curiosities uncovered. A brick with a dog's footprint in it, a pike blade found buried under the north portico, an ancient pair of workmen's shoes. All the principal rooms of the main floor, those used for state occasions, were to be rebuilt as faithful reproductions of the original rooms. The second and ground floors, too, would be restored with only minor changes. The best of the original furnishings, beyond what was already at Blair House, had been put in storage at the National Gallery. Old mahogany doors and window sashes, mantelpieces, hardware and floorboards deemed worth saving for reuse in the building, all paneling from the East Room and State Dining Room, were numbered, tagged, and carried away to federal warehouses across town. 20 surplus mantels were given to museums, while some 95,000 old bricks were trucked off to Mount Vernon for the restoration of garden walls and to reconstruct George Washington's orangery. The public, too, was offered the choice of a dozen different White House relic kits, these ranging from a single foot-long piece of original hand-split lath for 25 cents to a single brick, as nearly whole as possible, for a dollar, to enough old pine to make a walking stick or gavel for $2. The charge was intended only to cover the cost of distribution. A small metal authentication plate was also provided with each item. For $100, one could get enough bricks to surface a fireplace. Truman had warmly endorsed the idea of offering such souvenirs, and receipts wound up exceeding expenses by $10,000. Originally, he had said he wanted to send gavels made of White House wood to all 48 state governors. When the stones showing the original stonemason's marks were uncovered, he ordered a large number of them removed, some to be reset in the walls of the restored ground floor kitchen, the rest to be sent to the grand lodges of the Masonic orders of every state, as a token of the bond between Freemasonry and the founding of the nation. But as the pace of demolition stepped up, an immense quantity of material that might have been saved was not. Tons of old pine flooring, scrap lumber, ancient plumbing fixtures, pine doors, brick and stone were hauled away to Forts Belvoir and Meyer in nearby Virginia, some of it to be used in construction, but the large part as landfill. Chair rails, door frames, beautiful plaster moldings, once they had been measured and cast for reproduction, were scrapped as part of the wreckage. For nearly a month, trucks loaded with White House debris went rolling back and forth across the Potomac to Virginia. By the standards of latter-day preservation work, this was a needless and tragic loss. The justification would be cost and the president's own desire to see the job finished in reasonable time. Before the renovation, there had been 62 rooms in the mansion, 26 halls and corridors, 14 bathrooms. With the project complete, there were to be more than 100 rooms, 40 corridors and halls, and 19 bathrooms. There would be 147 windows, 412 doors, 29 fireplaces, 12 chimneys, 3 elevators. There would also be a television broadcast room and a bomb shelter, two definite and costly signs of the times. Most of the additional rooms and baths were on the third floor, 31 rooms and 9 baths, and in the new basement levels, which, when finished, would resemble the offstage service and utility complex of an up-to-date 1950s hotel. There were storage rooms, a laundry, a dental clinic, medical clinic, staff kitchen, barbershop, pantries, everything very institutional-looking. Few buildings anywhere in the country had such advanced mechanical and electrical equipment as went into the new White House that was emerging. The main electrical control panel looked big enough for a theater. Plumbing, heating, air conditioning, kitchen appliances, elevators, incinerator, fire alarm systems, wall safes, all were the most advanced of the day and cost well over $1.25 million. To accommodate the refrigeration compressors for the air conditioning, a tremendous additional excavation had to be made outside, next to the north portico. To make the lowest basement bomb-proof, an additional $868,000 was spent, and with no questions asked. The Secret Service and Truman's military advisors had convinced him of the necessity. The decision was made in the grim first months of the Korean War, when it seemed a Third World War could come any time. The President has authorized certain protective measures at basement level in and adjacent to the wings of the White House, the Commission was informed on August 16, 1950. Plans for this work are now being developed by the architect of the White House. The change meant many tons of additional steel and concrete in corridor walls and the floor above, work that was rushed ahead full speed. The bomb shelter was completed in less than a year, long before the upstairs levels were even close to finished. The entrance, at the end of a subterranean passage at the northeast end of the house, was a 4-inch-thick steel door with a narrow window at eye level, like the entrance to a speakeasy. In the event that the president and those with him reached the shelter after an atomic attack had already occurred, they were to shed their clothes once inside a small entrance hall, then, naked, proceed to another somewhat larger hall where they would shower to remove any radioactive material and put on emergency clothing, which by the summer of 1951, like everything else in the shelter, was all ready and waiting. Beyond was a large room with some 70 army cots neatly stacked against one wall, gas masks, chemical toilets, and acetylene torches in case the occupants had to cut their way out of the steel door. In adjacent rooms were an emergency generator, a larder of army rations, and a communications center with radios, cryptographic machines, and telephone switchboard with direct lines to the Pentagon, state police headquarters, and a secret military relocation center near Leesburg known as Mount Weather. Accommodations for the president and his family consisted of an 8-by-10-foot room, 4 bunk beds, a toilet, and a supply of books. Those inside, Truman was informed during a first visit to the shelter, would probably survive an atomic attack. The facility, however, would not sustain a direct hit. As the Secret Service and most of his staff already knew, Truman intended, in the event of an attack, to remain at the White House or in the shelter, both during and afterward, largely for morale reasons. Once, when a radar operator incorrectly reported the approach of 25 unscheduled unidentified planes, which turned out to be one plane, and several of the White House staff went below to the shelter, Truman did not. In the early months of the White House project, the work had proceeded ahead of schedule. But with the onset of the Korean War and increasing shortages of building materials, progress slowed. Costs began to rise. About 250 men were on the job. The work went on 6 days a week. Truman came and went repeatedly, so often as time passed that the men scarcely bothered to glance up or take notice. He considered it his project. He was saving the White House, remembered Rex Skouten, one of the Secret Service agents who regularly accompanied the president on such rounds and who years later would become head usher, then curator of the White House. He was also showing his desire to get it done with. Truman wanted everything handled correctly, on the job and on paper. When he learned of a movement within the commission to dispense with making complete plans of the installations in the new building, as a way of cutting costs, he responded at once with a terse memorandum to the head of the General Services Administration. "It is absolutely essential that the conduits, both wire and water, and all the complicated arrangements underneath the floors in the air conditioning service be put on paper so that future mechanics of the White House can find things when it is necessary to make repairs. One of the difficulties with the old White House was that nobody knew where anything went and why it was there. Now, there just isn't any sense in not having in the archives, in the General Service Headquarters, and in the White House, complete plans of all installations. I want this done, and if it requires an extra appropriation to get it done, we will get that done too." His own principal contribution to the design of the building concerned the grand stairway, which he insisted be relocated to the east side of the main entrance hall and made more open, more fitting for the ceremonial processions of the president and his guests of honor. Before, the stairway had been largely out of sight. Often over the years, Truman had told friends and members of his staff that had he been forced as a young man to choose a profession other than politics, he would have been either a farmer, an historian, or an architect. Now, working with Winslow, he could pore over plans and drawings to his heart's content, as he had once with Edward Nild when building the Kansas City courthouse. And at first, he and Winslow got along extremely well. A tall, personable, highly gifted man, Winslow had been an important figure at the White House since the 1930s. He cared immensely about the building, knew and loved its history. Privately, he even communed with the spirits of a few departed presidents. "Franklin Roosevelt appeared and presented a rose to me, as did Andrew Jackson," Winslow had recorded in his diary after an evening over a Ouija board in the summer of 1950. A married man, he was also romantically involved with several women, and while Truman seems to have been aware of this, he appears only to have grown annoyed by it when the project started to fall behind schedule. Losing his patience, Truman could often become quite abrupt with Winslow. Most of the time, however, they worked smoothly together, each admiring the other's strengths and pleased to find how often they agreed. Winslow would write long memoranda reporting on progress or listing current problems, and Truman would give his answers in the margins or between paragraphs in longhand. When, for example, Winslow reported that the commission intended to dismantle the temporary sheds on the South Lawn and set up various storage rooms and facilities for the workers in the new basement areas, Truman scrawled, "No, HST."
"It is probable," Winslow continued, "that ground floor areas will be used for contractors' offices, and without a doubt there will be considerable damage done to the various interior finishes that cannot be repaired satisfactorily at the last minute.
Don't use them. HST.
The basement areas should be kept as clean as possible after being finished. For any of these areas to be put into use as storage and dressing rooms for laborers and mechanics is inconceivable in a residence of this kind.
Just do not do it. HST.
I am inclined to believe that the sheds on the South Lawn should remain until nearly all the work is finished throughout the interior of the building. If this is done, all tools, paint, and other materials may remain stored outside the building where they properly should be stored.
Right.
As each room is completely finished, it should be locked and kept locked until the furnishings are moved in for occupancy. After that time, no workmen or government personnel should be permitted free access throughout the building without specific permission from the executive director of the commission.
Right as can be. HST.
In August 1951, the plasterers went out on strike for 2 weeks, slowing progress still more. The laying of the fine parquet floors, a slow process at best, seemed to go on endlessly. Since few craftsmen could be found who knew how the work should be done, and those available were often advanced in years and worked very slowly. The contract for furnishing and decorating the house went to B. Altman and Company of New York, which did the entire project at cost. When a number of socially prominent New Yorkers who had served on a White House advisory committee in years past began pressing for the chance to contribute their views, Truman wrote that, "I want it distinctly understood that this matter will be closely watched by me and that no special privileged people will be allowed to decide what will be done. I am very much interested in the proper replacement of the furniture in the White House, in the manner in which it should be placed, and since I am the only president in 50 years who has had any interest whatever in the rehabilitation of the White House, I am going to see that it is done properly and correctly." This settled, the work went on, directed principally by B. Altman's young chief of design, Charles T. Haight, who was tireless, forceful, and got along well with both the president and the first lady, even as Truman made his presence felt more and more. He kept pressing for greater speed. He wanted everything ready by Christmas 1951. He hoped to have at least a year in the House before his term of office expired. As the new year began, work on the floors was still behind schedule. Installation of marble and paneling was incomplete, bath fixtures had yet to arrive, and though some 20 painters were at work, only the third floor, the guest and servant quarters, had been finished. There was no let-up in the racket and confusion. In February 1952, the main floor was a thicket of scaffolding, paint buckets, and stacks of lumber, as Truman led a half-dozen reporters on a preview tour. The builders were speeding things up, he said, obviously pleased. He had taken a curry comb to them. He intended to move in by April. The reporters confessed difficulty in imagining how the finished interior would look. On March 15th, the New York Times reported that things were moving at the double quick at the White House.
Two large moving vans stood under the White House front portico. From them, movers carried furniture through the White House double doors. Graders were smoothing off a new front lawn just ahead of landscapers who were rolling down turf that arrived in great truckloads. 12 days later, late in the afternoon of Thursday, March 27th, Truman arrived back in Washington after a week's stay at Key West, and joined by Bess, was driven to the White House, entering by the North Gate on Pennsylvania Avenue. It was spring again, and the mansion looked warm and cheerful in the dusk, with lights glowing from every window on the ground floor. As a further note of cheer, a large cherry tree in full blossom had been planted just that day in the front lawn. Beneath the north portico, several of the White House staff, members of the commission, and others stood waiting with a cluster of reporters, photographers, and newsreel cameramen. Along the sidewalk by the iron fence, a crowd applauded and called welcome. Head usher Howell Krim greeted the president at the door. John Mays, the veteran doorkeeper, who had been at the White House since the time of William Howard Taft, took the president's coat. Truman, tanned and appearing in excellent health, obviously highly pleased, as reporters jotted in their notebooks, stepped inside. After an absence of 3 years, 4 months, the President of the United States was again in residence at the White House. Every light was burning. Everything shimmered with light. Crystal chandeliers and red carpets, window glass, marble columns, gilt-framed mirrors. Wood floors shone like polished glass. Walls and ceilings glistened with new paint. The effect was stunning. It all looked much the same as before, yet brighter, more spacious, and finished to perfection. With Bess, Truman toured the whole of the first floor. To the white and lemon-gold splendor of the East Room had been added new mantelpieces of Tennessee marble, in honor of the chairman of the commission, Senator McKellar. Except for two magnificent grand pianos standing in opposite corners and two newly acquired Adam benches against the far wall, 18th-century benches designed by John Adam of Edinburgh, the room was bare of furniture, its parquet floor shining like glass beneath the same two crystal chandeliers that had hung there before, but that had been reduced slightly in scale. The green room, once Jefferson's bedroom, later a dining room, later still a diplomatic reception room, looked no different from before, with the same silk on the walls, the same white Carrara marble mantels ordered by James Hoban in 1816. Above the entrance to the blue room, however, was a new presidential seal. Previously, the seal had been embedded in the floor of the main hallway, but Truman had insisted it be moved. He didn't like the idea of people walking on it. The oval-shaped blue room itself had been changed from dark to royal blue, with a large motif in gold on its silk damask walls, while the red room had new damask walls, new draperies and valences, all very red, setting off another Hoban mantle of lustrous white Carrara marble. Truman was particularly fond of a small French clock on the mantle in the Red Room, and of four portraits on the walls, of William McKinley, Grover Cleveland, Theodore Roosevelt, and Woodrow Wilson. The painting of Roosevelt by John Singer Sargent was, Truman liked to say, the most expensive picture in the house. Where the state dining room had been formerly rather subdued, even somber with dark oak paneling, it was now painted a soft green. A lovely color, Truman thought. And a large portrait of Abraham Lincoln by George P. A. Healy hung now over the mantel in a heavy gilt frame. Because Bess had made a previous commitment to appear at a Salvation Army dinner at the Statler that evening, Truman dined alone in the family dining room off the state dining room, under a recently donated antique cut glass chandelier, and a spotless replacement of the ceiling where Margaret's piano had once poked a hole. Bess and I looked over the East Room, Green Room, Blue Room, Red Room, and State Dining Room, he recorded that night. They are lovely. So is the hall and state stairway. I spent the evening going over the house. With all the trouble and worry, it is worth it. The cost had been $5,832,000. It could have been done for less, he thought, and taken less time if he had been fully in charge. But he was extremely pleased all the same. He had been told by the architect and engineers that it had been built to last another 500 years. He hoped it would be 1,000 years. On Tuesday, April 22nd, when the White House was reopened for public tours, 5,444 people went through. On Saturday afternoon, May 3rd, with the pride of a new householder, Truman led his own television tour of the mansion. The broadcast was carried by all three networks, and three network announcers, Walter Cronkite of CBS, Bryson Rash of ABC, and NBC's Frank Burgholzer, took turns accompanying him and asking questions. 30 million people were watching, the largest audience ever for a house tour. There was no script, and Truman was at his best, relaxed, gracious, amusing, and knowledgeable. His poise, his naturally hearty laugh, and his intuitive dignity made for an unusual and absorbing video experience, wrote Jack Gould, television critic for the New York Times. In the East Room, to demonstrate the tone of the magnificent Steinway, "The most wonderful tones of any piano I have ever heard," Truman told Frank Burgholzer, he sat down and gave an impromptu performance of part of Mozart's Ninth Sonata, then crossed the room to the Baldwin, an American-made piano, as he said, and from a standing position, played a few more bars on it as well. He spoke of Alice Roosevelt's wedding in the East Room, and recalled that Franklin Roosevelt had lain in state there. "The president was an inexhaustible source of information," wrote Jack Gould. "He explained the decor and furnishings and offered a host of anecdotes on former occupants of the White House. Yet through his narratives there always ran an underlying note of deeply sincere and moving awe for the historic continuity of the presidency." Time called his performance outstanding. The country loved the new White House, and for the moment, very much liked the man who occupied it. Section 3. For quite some time, Truman had been thinking about the question of a successor, someone to head the Democratic ticket in November 1952 and take his place in the White House after Inauguration Day in January 1953. The Republicans, he expected, would choose Taft, and the prospect of Taft as president was intolerable to Truman. There must be no isolationist takeover that would destroy everything he had worked for. By late summer 1951, he appears to have concluded that the ideal Democratic candidate, the most logical and qualified, was Chief Justice Fred Vinson. But Vinson declined, saying he had been out of politics too long. In November, Truman tried again, inviting Vinson to Key West, where they could talk freely in the privacy of the little White House, but not until after Truman had had a meeting with Eisenhower, over which there was to be a good deal of controversy. Whether Eisenhower, still the nation's number one hero, would run for president remained the great imponderable. Though, to judge by reports coming from his NATO headquarters in Paris, he was warming to the idea. The first week of November, on a brief visit to Washington, the general had lunch with Truman at Blair House, and reportedly Truman again offered his full support if Eisenhower would accept the Democratic nomination. The meeting took place on the 5th. On the 7th, Arthur Kroc broke the story in the New York Times. Kroc's source, he later disclosed, was Justice William O. Douglas, who told Kroc he had heard it from Truman himself, and in the presence of Chief Justice Vinson and one or two others from the court, during a reception at Blair House later the same day as Truman's lunch with Eisenhower. "You can't join a party just to run for office," Eisenhower was described saying to Truman. "What reason have you to think I have ever been a Democrat? You know I have been a Republican all my life and that my family have always been Republicans." At Key West a week later, Truman denied the story, as had Eisenhower in Paris, both publicly and privately. "He told me Arthur Kroc's story that Truman had offered him the Democratic candidacy in 1952 wasn't really true," Kroc's colleague on the Times, C.L. Sulzberger, recorded after an evening with Eisenhower in Paris. "He told me this twice, before dinner and after dinner. When he first met Truman on this trip, they winked at each other and by mutual agreement said right away there was one subject they weren't going to talk about. And that was the closest they ever came to politics." When Vinson arrived at Key West, Truman told him the nomination was his if he would accept. Vinson was tentative, saying he needed time to discuss the matter with his wife. Later, in Washington, Vinson told Truman he did not think the Supreme Court should be seen as a stepping stone to the White House. When Truman countered with the example of Chief Justice Charles Evans Hughes, who as the Republican candidate in 1916 nearly defeated Woodrow Wilson, Vinson declined for reasons of health, and apparently to Truman's great surprise. But Vinson, who had always looked sallow, was indeed in poor health. He would die 2 years later, in September 1953, at age 61. As the year ended, Truman seems to have been in something of a quandary, even about his own intentions. As implied in a longhand letter to Eisenhower, dated December 18, 1951. "Dear Ike, the columnists, the slick magazines, and all the political people who like to speculate are saying many things about what is to happen in 1952. As I told you in 1948 and at our luncheon in 1951, do what you think best for the country. My own position is in the balance. If I do what I want to do, I'll go back to Missouri and maybe run for the Senate. If you decide to finish the European job, and I don't know who else can, I must keep the isolationists out of the White House. I wish you would let me know what you intend to do. It will be between us and no one else. I have the utmost confidence in your judgment and your patriotism." He, too, would like to live a semi-retired life with his family, Eisenhower wrote in reply to Truman. "But just as you have decided that circumstances may not permit you to do exactly as you please, so I've found that fervent desire may sometimes have to give way to conviction of duty." He would not seek the presidency, Eisenhower said. Further, "You know far better than I that the possibility that I will ever be drawn into political activity is so remote as to be negligible." Eisenhower's letter was delivered New Year's Day, 1952. 5 days later, Senator Henry Cabot Lodge announced in Washington the formation of an Eisenhower for President campaign. And the following day in Paris, January 7th, Eisenhower announced he was prepared to accept the Republican nomination. Asked at his next press conference what he thought of the announcement, Truman had only praise for Eisenhower. "He was a grand man," Truman said. "I am just as fond of General Eisenhower as I can be. I think he is one of the great men produced by World War II. I don't want to stand in his way at all because I think very highly of him.
and if he wants to get out and have all the mud and rotten eggs thrown at him, that's his business. As the Eisenhower boom gathered force, Truman would remark to his staff, an edge of sadness in his voice, "I'm sorry to see these fellows get Ike into this business, showing him gates of gold and silver, which will turn out copper and tin." With Vinson no longer a possibility for the Democratic nomination, Truman decided the best choice would be Governor Adlai E. Stevenson of Illinois. Alvin Barkley, at 74, was too old. The presidency would kill Barkley in 3 months, Truman thought. "It takes him 5 minutes to sign his name," Truman noted sadly in his diary. Averill Harriman, whom Truman judged the ablest of them all, had never run for office and would be severely handicapped by his Wall Street background. "Can we elect a Wall Street banker and railroad tycoon president of the United States on a Democratic ticket?" Senator Estes Kefauver, a possibility, was a man Truman instinctively disliked and distrusted, a feeling shared by most of the party regulars. Privately, Truman referred to him as cow fever. Adlai Stevenson, by contrast, was comparatively young at 51. He was able, progressive, the governor of a major industrial state, a champion of honest government, and a new face. Stevenson had carried Illinois in 1948 by an overwhelming 570,000 votes in his first campaign for any office, a point that greatly impressed Truman. "He proved in that contest," Truman would write, "that he possessed a knowledge and feel for politics, that he understood that politics at its best was the business and art of government, and that he had learned that a knowledge of politics is necessary to carry out the function of our form of free government." That Truman should turn to Stevenson was greatly to Truman's credit. For not only was Stevenson still a political unknown nationally, but a man altogether unlike Truman. A graduate of Princeton, well-born, a prosperous lawyer, eloquent, witty, urbane, and divorced, Stevenson could hardly have been more different from Truman, or from most political figures of the day. Further, Truman hardly knew him. But Truman had read Stevenson's speeches. He liked what he heard, admired Stevenson's political philosophy, his Midwest background, his political heritage. The fact that Stevenson's grandfather, the first Adlai E. Stevenson, had been a Democratic congressman and vice president under Grover Cleveland. "He comes of a political family," Truman noted approvingly. Also, several of the younger aides at the White House were keenly interested in Stevenson, seeing in him qualities of the kind needed to revitalize the Democratic Party. Dispensing with any pretense of roundabout overtures, Truman asked the governor to come see him, and for an hour or more, the evening of Tuesday, January 22, 1952, they met alone in the seclusion of Blair House. Once Stevenson had talked his way past the guards outside who had never heard of him. As Truman later recounted the conversation, he spoke to Stevenson at length about the office of the presidency, then asked him to take it, saying he need only agree and the nomination was his. He could count on Truman's unqualified endorsement. "I told him I would not run for president again," Truman recorded in notes made afterward, "and that it was my opinion he was best fitted for the place." He was overcome. "I offered to have him nominated by the Democratic Convention in July. I had to explain to him that any president can control his party's convention. Then I cited Jackson, Hayes, Teddy Roosevelt, Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt, and myself at Philadelphia in 1948. I reminded him that Washington picked John Adams, that Jefferson did the same with Madison and Monroe before conventions were used. I told him I could get him nominated whether he wanted to be or not. Then I asked what he'd do in that case. He was very much worried,
and said that no patriot could say no to such a condition. But that night Stevenson said no. He apparently was flabbergasted, concluded Truman, who refused to give up. Stevenson, according to a close friend, came away filled with admiration for Truman, who had been sitting by the fire reading the Bible when Stevenson arrived. Stevenson was impressed with this self-contained, internally secure man that Truman was, remembered Carl McGowan. A simple man of great strength. Stevenson, with his own churning around, was impressed with the calm, serenity, self-contained quality. As Stevenson later confided to James Reston, Truman had said Stevenson was the man to defeat Eisenhower, who would most likely be the Republican candidate. Eisenhower's intentions were good, Truman had said, but he was inexperienced in politics and bound to become the captive of Taft and so destroy Truman's foreign and domestic programs. It was therefore essential that a Democratic administration be continued in the White House. The president wanted him to save the world from Dwight Eisenhower, Stevenson told Reston, highly agitated. According to another Stevenson friend, George Ball, who had driven Stevenson to and from Blair House that night, Truman had also observed at one point, "Hadley, if a knucklehead like me can be president and not do too badly, think what a really educated, smart guy like you could do in the job." But Stevenson had said no to Truman. Not only did he wish to remain governor of Illinois, he was less than certain that a change in Washington, a Republican administration, would be a bad thing for the country. Privately, he wondered if the Democrats had been in power too long. And in any event, he did not feel that being Truman's hand-picked candidate would be necessarily an advantage, given the woeful state of Truman's popularity. If Eisenhower were the Republican candidate, Stevenson told George Ball, nobody could beat him. On March 4th, Truman and Stevenson met again at Blair House, this time at Stevenson's request. "He came to tell me that he had made a commitment to run for re-election in Illinois," Truman wrote, "and that he did not think he could go back on that commitment honorably. I appreciate his viewpoint. He is an honorable man. Wish I could have talked with him before his announcement. He is a modest man, too. He seems to think that I am something of a superman, which isn't true, of course. He argued that only I can beat any Republican, be he Taft, Eisenhower, or Warren, or anyone else. My wife and daughter had said the same thing to me an hour before. What the hell am I to do? I'll know when the time comes, because I am sure God Almighty will guide me." For several weeks, Truman toyed with the prospect of running again. Some of the staff felt sure he had changed his mind and was about to announce his candidacy. On March 11th, Estes Kefauver won a stunning victory in the New Hampshire primary, having stumped the state wearing his trademark coonskin cap and accusing the administration of doing too little to get rid of corruption. Truman had allowed his name to be entered, but did not campaign. He thought primaries were a lot of eyewash. Still, Kefauver had challenged a president and won handily. At a small private dinner at Blair House for a few close advisers, including the new Democratic chairman Frank McKinney, Truman polled the table. Should he become a candidate to succeed himself? The answer, put as tactfully as possible, was no. Truman left for Key West, and on March 22nd called Clark Clifford and asked him to come down. The following day they sat alone in the garden behind the little White House. Clifford told the president he hoped he would not run again. Truman expressed concern over the effect his withdrawal might have on the war in Korea. Clifford answered that the course of the war had long been established. The same day, from Key West, March 23rd, A White House aide named David Lloyd, who had once worked with Stevenson when Stevenson was with the State Department, wrote to the governor without Truman's knowledge, urging him to reconsider, and in large part because of Truman. "Anybody who works closely with that man loves him. So I am prejudiced and think, like the others, that he ought to have what he wants. Because of all he has put into the job, because of the way he has given himself to it, because of the things he has done for us all, I feel that if he wants to quit and wants you to take the job, he ought to have his way. This may sound a little rough on you, but there is more to it than my personal feelings about him. We have to support him because of the things he represents, which are the things we believe in. If we don't support him, then we signify to the world that we aren't really taking seriously the things we talk about and work for, and the world will cease to take us seriously." On their way to the Jefferson-Jackson Day dinner, the huge annual $100-a-plate black tie gathering of Democrats held the evening of March 29th in the National Armory, Alice Acheson asked her husband if he thought the president might disclose his political future in his after-dinner speech. "Not at all," said the Secretary of State, in what, as she subsequently told him, was a notably superior manner. "It would be too early for the president to announce an intention not to run again," Acheson explained, "and too disappointing to many at the dinner were he to announce the contrary." Truman appeared at the podium looking tanned and uplifted by the occasion. At the end of a lively, fighting speech, having duly assaulted the Republicans and championed his own record, he put aside his prepared text and gave his answer. "I shall not be a candidate for re-election. I have served my country long, and I think efficiently and honestly. I shall not accept a renomination. I do not feel that it is my duty to spend another 4 years in the White House." It was said without build-up, almost matter-of-factly, and for a few seconds the immense audience sat silent and confused. Then followed a strange mixture of automatic applause and shouted cries of "No!" even from some of those who had hoped he would step down. "I found myself shouting no with vigor," recalled Arthur Schlesinger, Jr., who had tried to stop Truman's nomination in 1948. "Then I wondered why the hell I was shouting no, since this is what I had been hoping would happen for months. Still, the shouts of no seemed the least due to the president for a noble and courageous renunciation." Truman left the hall quickly, smiling, waving, yet looking somewhat tense, though the First Lady had a very different expression. "When you made your announcement," Harry Vaughan later told the president, "Mrs. Truman looked the way you do when you draw four aces." At the White House, as the president and First Lady arrived, many of the household staff who stood waiting at the door were crying. Did he plan to run for the Senate? Truman was asked a few days later at his next press conference. "No," he said. Mrs. Truman did not want him to, he had told his staff. Did he favor Governor Stevenson for the nomination? No comment. From Springfield, Stevenson had written, "I was stunned by your announcement Saturday night after that superb speech. I can only accept your judgment that the decision was right, although I had hoped long and prayerfully that it might be otherwise. As for myself, I shall make no effort to express the depth of my gratitude for your confidence. I hope you don't feel that I am insensitive to either that confidence or the honor you have done me." Replying immediately, Truman said he appreciated Stevenson's letter most highly. The need was for a man who would carry on the foreign policy of the United States as it was established in 1938 by President Roosevelt and carried through by me to the best of my ability. We must also have a president who believes in the domestic policies which have made the foreign policy possible, for the one was not possible without the other. I sincerely hope you will not take yourself completely out of the picture. Characteristically, whatever his frustrations with Stevenson, Truman would keep trying. Section 4. How the president got through the first weeks of April, wrote Roger Tubby, was a testimony to his amazing stamina. Tubby himself, as he wrote, felt more dead than alive. On April 3rd, Truman fired Attorney General McGrath, who for months had appeared to be obstructing the investigations Truman ordered into corruption in the Bureau of Internal Revenue. Feeling he had been sold down the river by people whom he trusted, Truman had turned the cleanup job over to McGrath in January 1952, which raised charges of an attempted whitewash, since McGrath was a former chairman of the Democratic National Committee. McGrath had then named a respected New York lawyer, a Republican, Newbold Morris, to head the investigation. But Morris had soon quarreled with McGrath and annoyed Congress. When Morris issued a long, intricate questionnaire to be filled out by all federal employees, including the cabinet, listing all assets and sources of income, McGrath exploded, calling the questionnaire an invasion of privacy and a violation of individual rights. McGrath refused to fill out the questionnaire, and after reading a copy, Truman, too, decided it should not be used. Truman despaired over McGrath's inability to get on top of his job. He liked McGrath. "I don't think there was the slightest thing wrong with Howard personally at all," he would later say, but found his performance frustrating. When, on April 3rd, McGrath announced he had fired Newbold Morris, and apparently with the idea that this was what Truman wanted, Truman fired McGrath. With this farcical denouement, as Cabell Phillips would write, the administration's house-cleaning effort seemed to have blown to pieces. It had been a miserable performance from start to finish, almost a burlesque of executive management, and the net result was to underline the mess in Washington as a good deal more than a gloating Republican catchphrase. Truman felt wretched about it all. In his memoirs, he would say nothing of the episode, but shortly afterward he wrote to McGrath, "I want you to know that my fondness for you has not changed one bit. Political situations sometimes cause one much pain." And by then, Truman was caught up in telephone and telegraph strikes, and the threat of another nationwide steel strike. He was showing the strain as those close to him had seldom seen. He looked stern in repose, his face deeply lined. After one morning staff meeting, when William Hopkins put the usual stack of papers in front of him to sign, Truman begged off until later, "when I'm not so shaky." He was tired, terribly tired, he admitted. At the White House the evening before, he had fallen asleep in his chair, something he almost never did. He seemed overburdened by his duties and decisions in a way he had never been before. It was as if the decision not to run again, the prospect of not being president, had taken something from him. In his diary, Roger Tubby wrote, "McGrath, Korean truce talks perhaps heading up to a settlement, the steel, telegraph, and telephone strikes, and his decision not to run again have been among the recent events draining on his emotional reserves. We were urging him to take a weekend off, to cut down on his afternoon appointments. He brightened, said he thought it a good idea to go downriver on the Williamsburg. But Matt reminded him he could not get away. There was a wreath-laying ceremony Sunday at the Jefferson Memorial. God, what a 3 weeks," he said with feeling. His appointment schedule for Tuesday, April 8th, the crucial day, was typical and did not even include what was to be the most important event of the day. 9:45. The Honorable Monsignor C. Walgren, called Mr. Conley. 10 o'clock, staff. 10:30, nothing. 11 o'clock, the Honorable Fred Lawton, Director of the Budget, wants half hour. 11:15, nothing. 11:30, the Honorable Clark Thompson, Congressman from Texas, leaving for Texas April 9th and asked to see the President before that time. 11:45, the Honorable Morgan Mulder, Congressman from Missouri, leaving soon for Missouri and asked to come in. 12 o'clock, the Honorable Ellsworth Bunker, newly appointed American Ambassador to Italy, in city April 7th to 9th and asked through state to see the President. 12:15, Mr. Alfred Kirsch. Mr. Kirsch is President and Treasurer of the West Disinfecting Company, Long Island City, called Mr. Connolly. 12:30, the Secretary of Defense, usual weekly appointment. 1 o'clock, lunch at Supreme Court. Justice Minton called the President. The President will leave the White House at 12:45 p.m. 3 o'clock, the Honorable Joseph Keenan, AF of L, called Mr. Connolly. 3:15, the Honorable Harley M. Kilgore, Senator from West Virginia, called Mr. Connolly. 3:30, Mr. James Patton, President of the Farmers Union, in city this week and requested appointment. 3:45, the Honorable J. Russell Young, Commissioner for District of Columbia, to submit his resignation, called Mr. Connolly. 4 o'clock, the Honorable Lister Hill, Senator from Alabama, called Mr. Connolly. 7:50, the President will leave White House to attend dinner at Shoreham given by National Conference on International Economic and Social Development. This is meeting in connection with Point 4. The President will speak at 9:45. As it turned out, he did not speak at the Shoreham as scheduled. The Secretary of State took his place. For it was that night in a nationwide radio and television broadcast from the White House that he announced he was seizing the steel mills. It was one of the boldest, most controversial decisions of his presidency. And like so much else, the seriousness of the crisis was compounded by Korea, the war that had come to overshadow his whole second term and that was rarely ever out of his thoughts. "These are not normal times," he would stress in his broadcast. "I have to think of our soldiers in Korea, the weapons and ammunition they need." Also, it being an election year, with, as he saw it, his whole domestic and foreign program at issue, he had no wish to alienate labor. From his reading of history, Truman was convinced his action fell within his powers as President and Commander-in-Chief. In a state of national emergency, Lincoln had suspended the right to habeas corpus, he would point out. Tom Clark, now on the Supreme Court, had once, as Attorney General, advised him that a president faced with a calamitous strike had the inherent power to prevent a paralysis of the national economy. Truman's legal advisers supported his views, and so, significantly, did Fred Vinson. According to later comments by John Snyder, the Chief Justice had confidentially advised the President that, on legal grounds, he could go ahead and seize the mills. Such counsel clearly violated the division between branches of government and was particularly improper in this instance, since a seizure of the steel industry was bound to be challenged in the courts, and thus Vinson himself, very likely, would wind up having to weigh the case. But out of friendship and loyalty, Vinson offered advice that was taken quite to heart. "The path was clear," Truman told the ever-cautious Snyder, who opposed seizing the mills. "The President has the power to keep the country from going to hell," Truman would assure his staff. A steel crisis had been a long time coming. Driven by the demands of the war, the mills were producing record tonnage. Profits, too, were on the rise. Yet steel workers, unlike workers in the auto and electrical industries, had had no pay raise since 1950. In November 1951, the 650,000 United Steelworkers, who were part of the CIO and headed by Phil Murray, called for a boost in wages of 35 cents an hour. Management refused to negotiate. The union gave notice that it would strike when its contract expired on December 31st. On December 22nd, Truman referred the dispute to his Wage Stabilization Board. And to maintain production, the union agreed to postpone the strike until April 8th. When, after weeks of hearings, the Wage Stabilization Board recommended an hourly raise of 26 cents, and the union quickly agreed, the companies denounced the proposal as unreasonable unless they could add a hefty increase of $12 a ton to the price of steel. Negotiations continued only to end in deadlock. With the April deadline approaching, the country, as said in the press, was caught squarely on the griddle. To Truman, the pay increase proposed by the Wage Stabilization Board seemed both fair and reasonable, and the most direct way to prevent a strike that would not only be a national emergency, but would critically impair the flow of munitions to Korea and to the buildup of NATO forces in Europe, which he saw as crucial. Secretary of Defense Lovett, Truman later wrote, said emphatically that any stoppage of steel production for even a short time would increase the risk we had taken in the stretch out of the armament program. He also pointed out that our entire combat technique in all three services depended on the fullest use of our industrial facilities. Stressing the situation in Korea, he said that we are holding the line with ammunition and not with the lives of our troops. Any curtailment of steel production, he warned, would endanger the lives of our fighting men. Truman refused to invoke the Taft-Hartley Act, by which the government could enjoin a strike for 80 days pending an impartial study, because he saw no sense in delaying a settlement still further and felt the facts were already well known. Also, the steelworkers had remained on the job voluntarily for nearly 3 months as it was. For them to continue thus another 80 days with no change in pay seemed to him unfair. Nor did the prospect of resorting to a law he disliked, and that labor despised, have any appeal. But it was Truman's fundamental feeling about the giants of the steel industry, the old distrust of big corporations that he had voiced with such passion during his years in the Senate, that moved him now, more than sympathy for the position of the steelworkers. He considered the industry's proposed price increase little better than profiteering, and saw the steel companies, with U.S. Steel in the lead, attempting to force a compromise that would ultimately play havoc with his anti-inflation policies and raise the cost of the war. The attitude of the companies seemed wrong to me, since under the accelerated defense program, the government was by far the biggest customer for steel and steel products. To hike prices at this time meant charging the government more for the tools of defense. While conceding that a modest $4.50 increase in steel prices might be tolerated, Truman stubbornly rejected industry demands out of hand and went over the head of his own director of defense mobilization, Charles E. Wilson, who saw validity in the industry position. As a result, Wilson resigned, a turn of events that Truman regretted and that brought down still more criticism on him. To Truman, seizure of the mills was a temporary last resort. On Tuesday, April 8th, only hours before the mills were scheduled to be struck, he made his move, signing Executive Order No. 10340. The plain fact of the matter is that the steel companies are recklessly forcing a shutdown, he told the country when he went on the air at 10:30 that night. They are trying to get special, preferred treatment, and they are apparently willing to stop steel production to get it. As President of the United States, it is my plain duty to keep this from happening. At midnight, the government will take over the steel plants. The broadcast over, on his way to his room, Truman looked so exhausted Joe Short thought he might collapse. In some ways, it was as though in the last act of his presidency, with less than a year to go, he had reverted to the man he had been in the spring of 1946, after less than a year in office, when faced by the great railroad impasse, he had tried to draft the striking workers into the army. At some 88 steel mills across the country, the morning of April 9th, 1952, things appeared the same as usual. The morning shifts arrived, production continued, the mills worked by the same men and managed by the same officials. The one clearly visible sign of change were the American flags that flew over the mills. In Washington, the Secretary of Commerce, Charles Sawyer, had assumed legal command of the industry. But Truman had brought on an additional crisis, a constitutional crisis, just as he would have in 1946 had the railroad unions not agreed at the last minute to settle the strike. The outcry now was instantaneous and as scathing nearly as what he had faced after the firing of MacArthur. He was called a Caesar, a Hitler, a bully and lawbreaker. In reporting his action to Congress in a special message delivered to the Hill immediately that same day, April 9th, he stressed that his action had been taken with utmost reluctance. The idea of government operation of the steel mills is thoroughly distasteful to me, and I want to see it ended as soon as possible. He acknowledged the power of Congress to supersede his policy and act on its own to pass a new law enabling the government to operate the mills as an emergency measure. Such legislation, he said, might be very desirable. But Congress did not choose to grant him such power. Instead, there were calls for congressional investigations, calls for his impeachment. The president's evil deed had no precedent in history, said the head of Inland Steel, Clarence Randall, in a radio and television broadcast. Time, Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report all attacked Truman. The Truman talent for trouble, said Newsweek, gave him and the nation no rest. The New York Times accused him of acting on almost inconceivably bad advice. The Washington Post predicted his seizure of the mills would probably go down in history as one of the most high-handed acts ever committed by an American president. Truman, said the Post, had grossly usurped the power of Congress, and in a constitutional democracy there was no more serious offense against good government. Nothing in the Constitution can be reasonably interpreted as giving to the Commander-in-Chief all the power that may be necessary for building up our defenses or even for carrying on a war. If he could seize the steel mills under his inherent powers, could he therefore, Truman was asked at a press conference, also seize the newspapers and radio stations? Under similar circumstances, the President of the United States has to act for whatever is best for the country, he answered abruptly and imprudently, stirring speculation that he was indeed planning to seize the press, an idea that had never occurred to him and that he couldn't imagine happening. The steel industry sued to get its property back. Swiftly, a federal district judge, David A. Pine, determined that seizure of the steel industry was illegal, and the Supreme Court announced it would hear the case. I believe, wrote Judge Pine in a 4,500-word opinion, that the contemplated strike, if it came, with all its awful results, would be less injurious to the public than the injury which would flow from a timorous judicial recognition that there is some basis for this claim to unlimited and unrestrained executive power. He had read the Pine opinion, Truman told his staff, read it, and still could not understand why he had been judged wrong. To Secretary of Commerce Sawyer, he confided that he would be terribly shocked, disappointed, and disturbed should the Supreme Court, too, decide against him. The president was depressed, recorded Roger Tubby after a morning staff meeting. I had never seen him so quiet and down. Occasionally there seemed to be an effort by him to laugh at our sallies, but the laughs were brief, his countenance mostly serious. Of course, the steel wrangle has troubled him. The touch-and-go situation in Korea, the Democratic Party uncertainties, and he's been terribly tired. He would, of course, abide by the court's ruling, Truman told reporters. He had no ambition to be a dictator. He just wanted to keep the country running. The case against the president was argued in the Supreme Court by the attorney for the U.S. Steel Corporation, white-haired John W. Davis, who had been the Democratic candidate for president in 1924 when he lost to Calvin Coolidge, and who, in a distinguished career, had argued more than 100 cases before the court. Defending the president was Solicitor General Perlman, whom Truman would later describe as an outstanding lawyer who presented the government's case ably and forcefully. On Monday, June 2nd, the court declared the president's action unconstitutional by a crushing majority of 6-3. Those in the majority were Hugo L. Black, who delivered the official opinion, Felix Frankfurter, Robert H. Jackson, William O. Douglas, and, as infuriated Truman, Tom Clark. We cannot, with faithfulness to our constitutional system, hold that the Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces has the ultimate power as such to take possession of private property in order to keep labor disputes from stopping production. Justice Black read slowly and calmly. This is a job for the nation's lawmakers, not for its military authorities. Today, wrote Justice Douglas in a concurring opinion, a kindly president uses the seizure power to effect a wage increase and to keep the steel furnaces in production. Yet tomorrow, another president might use the same power to prevent a wage increase, to curb trade unionists, to regiment labor as oppressively as industry thinks it has been regimented by this seizure. The Chief Justice, who strongly upheld the president, arguing that he had acted entirely within his constitutional responsibilities, was joined in the minority by Justices Stanley F. Reed and Sherman Minton. Any man worthy of the office of the presidency, Vinson argued, should be free to take at least interim action necessary to execute legislative programs essential to survival of the nation. Nor was there any question that the possession of the steel industry was other than temporary in character and subject to congressional approval, disapproval, or regulation of the manner in which the mills were to be administered and returned to the owners. For Truman, it was a humiliating defeat, and at the hands of old friends and fellow spirits. It was a liberal court. Hugo Black had been an ardent New Dealer. All 9 justices had been appointed either by Truman or Roosevelt. That Tom Clark had gone against him would anger Truman for years. Putting that damn fool from Texas on the Supreme Court, he would one day tell the author Merle Miller, was the biggest mistake he made as president. though this, like others of his observations to Miller, was more harsh than he meant or than he indicated at the time. As a gesture of friendship and goodwill, Hugo Black invited the president and the justices to a party at his beautiful home across the river in Old Town Alexandria. At the start of the evening, Truman, though polite, seemed a bit testy, remembered William O. Douglas. But after the bourbon and canapes were passed, he turned to Hugo and said, "Hugo, I don't much care for your law, but by golly, this bourbon is good." The steel strike that began after the court decision of June 2nd dragged on for 7 weeks, until midsummer 1952, making it the longest, most costly steel strike in the nation's history. Losses in production, losses in wages, were unprecedented. 21 million tons of steel and $400 million in wages, as 600,000 steel workers and 1,400,000 others in related industries were idle. The military output scheduled for 1952 was cut by a third. "No enemy nation could have so crippled our production as has this work stoppage," said Robert Lovett bitterly. "The weird and tragic thing is that we have done this to ourselves." The settlement called for a 21-cent-an-hour raise for the workers and a steel price increase of $5.20 a ton, which was the same as the $4.50 offered by the government months earlier, plus 70 cents for increased freight rates. In the long weeks of the strike, Truman had grown increasingly distressed over congressional inaction. Congress declined to do anything more than request, rather than direct him, to use the Taft-Hartley Act, thus sending the problem and responsibility for the decision right back to him. And whether steel production would resume were he to invoke Taft-Hartley was highly debatable. "The court and Congress got us into the fix we're now in," he told his staff. "Let Congress do something about getting us out." Discouraged that so few Democrats on the Hill had come to his support, discouraged that practically no Democrats up there were fighting for his foreign aid bill, he grumbled that maybe it might be good for the Democrats to be out of power for a while. For the first time since taking office, he felt ill. At the Army's Walter Reed Hospital years earlier, a special presidential suite had been set up on the third floor in the event that he needed medical attention. But it had never once been used. Truman had never been sick until the morning of July 16th, when he awoke feeling poorly and Wallace Graham found he was running a low fever. 2 days later, with what Graham called a mild virus, he was driven to Walter Reed. He stayed